The Electoral College is one of the longest standing institutions in American politics, but it's become one of the most controversial as well. Presidential elections in 2000 and 2016 saw candidates win a majority of electoral votes while losing the popular vote. That's led many people to say we should get rid of the Electoral College, but the prospect of making that happen is slim. Our next guest says that looking back to the original vision of the Electoral College can give us some direction. He says that today it isn't doing what our founders hoped it would, and there are changes both parties could support to get it back on track. Edward Foley is a professor of law at The Ohio State University and author of the book Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. Ned, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for spending some time with us. We really appreciate it. Now, Ned, you've gone back and way back in the day and dug into the debates our founders had in this country's early years and how they thought the president should be elected. So it sounds like most were committed to the idea of majority rule, but they didn't want to rely on a simple popular vote. So what were they hoping to achieve?
Well, that's exactly right. Given the fact that it's the United States, this collection of states, and they believed in that federalism principle that it was a union of states, they had a kind of a majority rule for this united country, which they considered was a compound majority. So it was a two-stage process. The candidates were supposed to get majority support within states and within enough states so that in the aggregate they could have the appropriate federal majority. So it wasn't just a simple, let's have all the voters all across America raise their hand. It was, let's go state by state and create majorities at the state level and aggregate that into a federal majority.
Now, there were a lot of intense debates, and you talked about that a little bit, about this issue before it got settled. But what were some of the competing ideas about how we should elect the president?
Sure, and we actually did a transformation, and this is what I think most people don't realize, because, again, it was a long, long time ago, and we weren't around back then.
Right.
So at the beginning, you know, we had our original Constitution that was the product of the convention in Philadelphia in 1787. And they had a vision then that they hoped would achieve consensus. They had in mind George Washington as the perfect president, and he became the first president, and they thought he would rise above factions. Remember, they didn't want to have political parties. It's so hard to imagine that now, but they thought they could actually create a constitution that would avoid the development of the two-party system as we now have come to know it, and they thought they would just have a bunch of different interest groups, farmers and bankers and merchants, but they wouldn't coalesce into parties. And they hoped that a president of the whole nation could kind of rise above all those interest groups and be a consensus choice. So they built a kind of complicated model with that in mind. That was 1787. That almost immediately broke down after George Washington's two terms. Now, he fit the vision, and he was as suitable for that. But then in his administration, even, two parties developed. And the founders, who had been united about the Constitution, like Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, who jointly wrote the Federalist Papers together in support of the Constitution, they suddenly become intense political opponents, where you have one party with John Adams and Alexander Hamilton on one side, and you've got Thomas Jefferson and James Madison on the other side. So this idea that the founders all agreed on everything, no. And the partisanship became, believe it or not, almost as intense as it is now. And we think we have the red-blue divide now. Well, they had something similar back then as they went into the election of 1800 in particular, and that was Adams versus Jefferson. And it was intense. And the system kind of broke down for reasons we could get into if we wanted to. But the key point is that after that, the dust settled, and Jefferson became president in 1800 based on what his party thought was he was the right guy, because he was the person who did have majority support in enough states to get this federal majority. But he thought that it was going to be stolen from him by the Adams supporters. But once they consolidated their power, the Jeffersonians, and they did, he became very popular partly for the Louisiana Purchase. So when he was looking ahead to his reelection in 1804, they redesigned the Electoral College and put it in what's the 12th Amendment to our Constitution. That's the Electoral College that governs us still today, not the 1787 version. They threw that out and replaced it. And now we have to think of Jefferson as the model president, not George Washington. They knew, his supporters knew, it wasn't going to be consensus and all kumbaya anymore, because they knew they were fighting Adams and Hamilton and the Federalists. And so they redesigned the system for what they thought was genuine majority rule, even if you couldn't have consensus. And that's the system that they put into place. And that was this. Jefferson was the right person, and he won re-election on this basis in 1804 because they got their amendment through, and he wins by accumulating the majority support of the states that give him his Electoral College victory. So that was how the system was supposed to work. And then for other historical complicated reasons, we've kind of fallen away from that majority rule vision, and now we can have presidents, as you said at the outset, elected with only minority support, not majority support. And so that's not what they wanted when they wrote the 12th Amendment to give us majority rule.
Edward Foley is a professor of law at The Ohio State University and author of the book Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And we are talking about how we can possibly fix the Electoral College system. Now, you talked about the 12th Amendment that was ratified in 1804, which gave us the modern form of the Electoral College. And as you spoke, Ned, you said it worked for a while, but near the middle of the century, it started to stray from that original vision. What are some of the things that happened?
Yeah, so what happens is that they leave in place this original provision that states can implement the system by choosing at the state level the method for appointing these electors, right, who are the members of the Electoral College. And when they wrote the 12th Amendment, they had in mind that states would choose among options, all of which would achieve majority rule at the state level, because that's all that they knew at the time. But they left in place this kind of Achilles heel, if you will, this vulnerability in the system that gave states the freedom to do whatever they wanted. And so then, as you say, along by the kind of middle of the 19th century, we get states abandoning at the state level the majority rule principle and allowing instead for candidates to get all of a state's electoral votes with only what's called a plurality of the popular vote. And plurality is less than 50%. So if there's more than two candidates, you could have a three-way split, and somebody could get all of Wisconsin's electoral votes with only 40% of the popular vote in Wisconsin. That's contrary to the vision that they want, the Jeffersonians wanted for the 12th Amendment. That creeps into the system, by the 1840s and 50s, this plurality system that allows for minority winners. But that's a deviation at the state level. So that's why. But it's kind of latent. It's a defect that doesn't really affect the system unless you've got three-way splits. And for a long, long time, we didn't have too many of them. But as you said, Ralph Nader in 2000, Ross Perot in 1992, there are a couple of elections, particularly recent elections, where a third candidate can really make a difference because of this plurality system that creeps in. And so If we want to get back to the original vision of majority rule, states can undo the problem that creeped in the middle of the 19th century by insisting at the state level on majority winners like they had before.
Edward Foley is a professor of law at The Ohio State University. He's also the author of the book Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And we're talking about the original intent of the Electoral College and some ideas for change. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think there should be changes made to the Electoral College? If so, would you make adjustments or get rid of it altogether? Do you have questions for our guests about what the intent of the founders was or how potential changes to the system would work? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we'll pick up this conversation in just a minute. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor. We're continuing our conversation about the Electoral College with Ned Foley. He is a professor of law at The Ohio State University and author of the book Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the Electoral College? If you think it needs to be reformed, what would you change? Do you think it's important that a candidate who gets a state's electoral votes actually wins the majority of its popular vote? What questions do you have for Ned about the Electoral College and its history? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, Ned, the Electoral College has gotten a lot of attention in more recent times thanks to the 2016 election as well as the election in 2000. And even before, how have things played out in those elections in terms of majority rule within the states? And let's start with 2016 first.
Sure. So everybody often talks about Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania as these, you know, three states that Trump unexpectedly won. But he didn't win a majority in those states. He got less than 50%. And that's because it wasn't just Hillary Clinton on the ballot. It wasn't just a two-way race. There was also Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, as well as others. And they factor. Now, I can't say for sure who would have won those states if it had just been a head-to-head competition. But the key point is at the state level, the rules allowed somebody to win without 50% and not only get some electoral votes from that state, but get all the marbles. That's the piece that the founders would have been so upset about. They contemplated the idea, and in fact some states did back then, where you'd divide a state's electoral votes if more than one candidate had significant support in the state. That was an option they considered, but they didn't want any one person to get all of the electoral votes if they were a minority candidate, minority meaning politically minority, less popular than the rest of the field. Sure. You shouldn't be able to get. So that was the objection. And yet that's what's in place, and that's what happened in 2016.
What about 2000?
Same thing, confined more to Florida. Ralph Nader affects that result. You know, it's Al Gore and George W. Bush. But Nader gets a significant amount of votes that affects what happens in Florida, and that, of course, affects what happens in the whole Electoral College. So same dynamic. 2016 is more widespread because it's actually six states where this same phenomenon, the big three of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, but also Arizona, Florida again, and North Carolina, are all states that Trump won all the electoral votes of those states, amounting to 101 electoral votes. He needed them to win nationally, but he was under 50% there. So that's and it's a this is a not both the reason why both parties should be concerned about this is either major party can be affected by this dynamic depending upon the relationship of the extra candidates to the two main contenders. So that's why Ross Perot, many people think, affected George H.W. Bush in 1992, you know, hurting the Republicans, whereas Ralph Nader affects Al Gore, hurting the Democrats. But looking forward, this could affect either party, and again, detracts from the basic principle that you're not really a winner of the people of that state unless you have majority support in that state.
Ned Foley is with us. He's a professor of law at The Ohio State University and author of the book Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And we're talking about the history of the Electoral College and whether the Electoral College needs some adjustments, or do we need to get rid of it altogether? Or should we do what the founders intended? Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Jeff in Superior. Good afternoon, Jeff. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi, I actually support the Electoral College for this reason. We live in a representative democracy, not a pure democracy. Therefore, when you look at the elections where the candidate got the most popular vote, the other candidate actually won a majority of the states. But I will agree that in a representative democracy, majority doesn't always rule. So I would support the idea of popular vote if they required a certain percentage of the population voting, and I think those voters should be U.S. citizens, not illegal aliens. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks so much for the call. What are your thoughts, Ned?
Yes, well, I think those are important points. In all 50 states right now, you are required to be a citizen to vote. And then the question is, how do we add up the votes of the eligible participants? And is there a threshold number that's necessary to win? And the founders agreed with Jeff in the sense they didn't want just one monolithic, simple tally. They did believe in a representative system, but the question is, how do you structure the representative system? And they wanted representation based on the idea that if you have to choose between a majority and a minority, between 51% and 49%, the 51% should govern the 49% rather than the vice versa. And that's clear in the debates of the 12th Amendment. If you've gone back and read the debates, they say that over and over and over again, because they don't want John Adams to win or other members of that party if they have only 49%. They want Jefferson to win, again, not at the national level, but building that coalition of states at the state level.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Frank in Madison. Good afternoon, Frank. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much. Listen, you don't have to abolish the Electoral College. There's a readily available solution: increase the size of the House of Representatives. That would help, I think, fight gerrymandering to some extent. Term limits, I think, would go away because representatives would be much closer to the people they represent, and you would reduce the effect of money in elections, because with an increased number of representatives running, those representatives would be fighting in smaller districts, and the effect of people in those districts, supporters in those districts, would outweigh the effect of the money of rich men, trying to flood the market with advertising for their favored lackeys.
Frank, thank you so much for the call. Ned, do you think adding more U.S. House of Representatives would help?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea for those reasons as well as others. But I also would caution folks to think about short-term reform and long-term reform and decide which reforms belong in which category. Because I think there are a lot of things, like getting rid of gerrymandering, a lot of things that should happen to improve American democracy. But one has to ask how realistic that is, in what time frame. And if you're concerned about the 2020 presidential election and you want that to be fair for people of Wisconsin, people of other states, you have to say, what's feasible between now and 2020? There's a window of opportunity, but it is closing. And so you have to say, is it more important to get some, maybe not best reform, but decent reform now? Or should you wait and strive for longer reform that might be more difficult to get? So I would put the change in the size of the House of Representatives into the long-term category. Definitely should be considered long, but I don't think that's realistic short term. I think it is more realistic in pivotal states like Wisconsin to say, hey, are we comfortable with electing presidents based on minority rule, or do we believe that democracy means majority rule? And if that's achieved in critical states like Wisconsin, that could really make a difference for 2020.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Marcia in Grafton. Good afternoon, Marcia. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi. I don't know if I'm using the right terms, but I want to know what ranked voting is, so that if you list your first, second, or third choice of candidates, so that you could cross, I'm assuming you could cross parties, you could go Democrat or Independent or Green Party or whatever, and list them in ranks, and that would prevent the catastrophe we're in right now.
Marcia, thank you so much for the call. Aren't there states that use ranked voting now?
Yes, Maine has just adopted it for congressional races. But Marcia's absolutely correct. That is, there's several different ways of achieving majority rule. And many people, including myself, think this ranked choice voting is actually probably the best. My point is that what our founders would have said is that any method that does majority rule is consistent with their vision. But this notion of ranked choice voting is consistent. One reason we know that is they actually used runoffs to achieve majority rule before they adopted the 12th Amendment, in Massachusetts and New Hampshire in particular. They didn't have the mechanism of a what we call instant runoff voting, which is another term for ranked choice voting, because they hadn't invented that yet. They had invented a two-stage runoff process. But insofar as ranked choice voting is a single-stage runoff process, the authors of the 12th Amendment would have said, hallelujah, you're doing exactly what we want you to do.
Weston emailed at ideas@WPR.org, said, I believe that the Electoral College is working reasonably well. The biggest problem facing the American people today is the two parties controlling our government. We need to find a way to break the grip of these two organizations who are more interested in maintaining power than what's good for the people. I would like to see changes made to the primary process and preference voting in elections. So with that said, with about a minute left, going forward, do you think we'll run into more of these controversial or seemingly undemocratic election results if we don't enact some type of change?
Yes. And the book that I'm working on now is showing that this new historical development means that what happened in 2016 is more likely to happen again because of current polarization and current disaffection with gridlock and the problems of government. So we're more likely to have what has happened this week, where you have somebody like Howard Schultz, the ex-Starbucks CEO, saying, hey, I want to get in the mix. So we're more likely to have a third party affecting the system. And in fact, if you want to open up the system so that we don't have just two parties, allowing a mechanism like ranked choice voting is the way to do it, because then it allows the existence of extra ideas to be in the system, but not mess the system up at the back end. The plurality system that we got in the middle of the 19th century is the worst system, because it kind of chokes off third parties and doesn't give them a real opportunity.
Ned, thanks so much for talking with us. Ned Foley is the chair in constitutional law at Ohio State University. He was with us to talk about ideas for electoral college reform that both major parties might be able to support.